I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad.
What if what we call public opinion was just a manufactured narrative that makes it easier to convince people that if their views are different, then there's something wrong with that, or there's something wrong with them?
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
Please shut down the system.
And now for Newsreel, these are your hosts, Maltos and Gatekeeper.
It is a good day. This is Mike reporting to you from the internet for Sunday, November 9th, 2014. You are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-rep on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening in and distributing this program, you are too. You can follow along with our news stories and check our facts out by going to newsreel.ca. This is a free WOGcast that can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, each and every Sunday afternoon at 1400 hours Pacific Time, or for you people who are not running on a 24-hour clock, that is 2 p.m. Pacific Time. So, welcome to another episode of Newsreel. It's been about 2 or 3 weeks since we did one, and we've got a little bit of a change here now. Sean, Gatekeeper, whatever you want to call him, the man that goes by many names, has dropped off of the Newsreel project. That's not a problem. He's got other projects that he wants to focus his time on, so that's cool. So we wish him all... Sorry, I wish him, because it's no we anymore, it's just me. So I wish him the best of luck in all of his endeavors. And hey, if anybody else wants to try out for co-host of Newsreel, go right ahead. Actually, it doesn't really matter. I'll probably just do it independently from now on, unless somebody actually does show some interest in it, then yeah, we'll see if we work things out. Anyways, I can't really, you know, cross-talk with Sean anymore, so there's no pandering going on today. So let's just head into the news, shall we? Because my week's boring, I'm not going to bore everybody else with it. In listener license news, thank you to Kevin as a Geek for this one. Nighttime Eiffel Tower photos are a copyright violation. This is a article from November 8th on, I don't know what website this is, torrentfreak.com, that's what it is. Didn't recognize the logo. Anyways, every day thousands of tourists in Paris snap a picture of the Eiffel Tower's famous light show. However, using those pictures in public may lead to unintended consequences, as pictures of France's most famous building, is it really a building? It's kind of just a tower, most famous building taken at night are protected by copyright. That seems kind of stupid. Well, it doesn't seem, it is kind of stupid. Most people know that they are not allowed to share copies of their favorite band or film without permission. However, in some areas, even your own creations may be illegal to share. In several countries, architectural structures are protected by copyright. That means you have to ask permission from the copyright holder to use your own picture in public. This is also true for the Eiffel Tower in Paris. The famous landmark was built in 1889, which means that it falls within the public domain. Yeah, because it's super freaking old. However, what is it like, I don't know what the public domain time frame is, 20 years, 30 years, more? Obviously this is passed either way. However, the light show was added later, and this is still protected by copyright. It may sound absurd, but taking a picture of the Eiffel Tower at night and sharing that online may be copyright infringement. Well, according to this, it is copyright infringement. The stance is confirmed by the society, the Eiffel Tower Exploitation Society, because I'm not reading that in French, who note the following on their website. Click on their website there. Quote, daytime views from the Eiffel Tower are rights free. However, its various illuminations are subject to author's rights as well as brand rights. Usage of these images is subject to prior requests from the Eiffel Tower Exploitation Society. Unquote. The issue above was brought to the forefront by the EU Observer, that's another news site or whatever, who note that taking pictures of public buildings may lead to copyright violations in France, Belgium, and Italy. Dimitar Dimitrov, yeah, I screwed that name up, I bet, policy expert for Wikipedia's European Wikimedia chapters in Brussels, told the EU Observer that nightly pictures of the Eiffel Tower may indeed be infringing. Quote, the light show is protected by copyright. Dimitrov notes. Similar legislation also prevents the public from using photographs of some famous landmarks in Belgium, including the Atomium, or Atomium, however you say that. This is also why the Atomium's Wikipedia entries, Wikipedia entry has censored versions or models of the building on its website instead of the real deal. Picture of the Wikipedia article for Atomium, or the Atomium, or whatever it is there. In most other countries in Europe, there is no ban on photos of architectural projects thanks to a clause in the EU's Information Society Directive. However, in Belgium, France, and Italy, this hasn't been transposed in the law. Lazy bastards. According to Dimitrov, this effectively means that people are not allowed to publicly use photos of the Atomium, Eiffel Tower at night, or any other copyrighted architecture, not even on social media. If you take an image of the Atomium and put it on Facebook, that is copyright infringement, Dimitrov says. Good luck enforcing that. I guess there's a clip, a link there. Excuse me. Yeah, it's very interesting because, actually, it's very stupid. It's light. It's light and patterns of light. I'm assuming it's set up kind of in a similar fashion to what the CN Tower in Toronto in Canada here is. It's got a light, this LED light display up the side of it, and it changes colors, and depending on the season or the holiday or whatever, they, you know, different light shows and stuff. But, you know what I mean? It's copyright infringement, so I take a picture of it. Well, what's the difference between taking a picture of it and looking at it with your eyes? It's not really much of a difference. You look at it with your eyes, you're gonna remember it, right? If you take a picture of it, it's just a different way of storing that memory or that data, really. It's not in your head, it's a hard copy, so to say. So it's stupid. It's like saying that, oh, you can't take a picture of this. It's like, that's exactly what it's saying. It's, you can't take a picture of this because of the lights and the brands involved with the lighting, and like, who cares? It's lights. It's like saying that you can't take a picture of the sun because at a certain time it's a different color, like, you know, it gets orangey when it gets close, starts going down, and blah, blah, blah. Oh, you can't take a picture of that because, who cares? It's just a pattern of light and a color of light and a combination of lights, and who cares? It's a light. So, that's pretty stupid. I feel sorry for, I don't feel sorry for anybody on that, actually. That's pretty stupid. That's just stupid. I'm rambling. This is horrible. But whatever. On to the next news story. In space news, this is a bit of a sad story, actually. Virgin Galactic crash. Worried passengers ask for refunds. Passengers ask for a refund isn't really sorry. It's kind of, you know, just that's their opinion. But the crash itself is pretty sad. Around 24 Virgin Galactic passengers have asked for refunds following the death of pilot Michael Aylesbury. This is near Cantel, California, I guess is where this spacecraft crashed. Virgin Galactic customers have started to ask for refunds over safety fears following the crash, which killed a co-pilot during testing, it has emerged. It is the first time that any of the 800 space tourists have pulled out, despite 10 years of delays. Galactic Chief Executive George Whiteside said it was unsurprising that some passengers were now cautious about the project. Yeah, that happens. You know, you have a crash. It's like when Ukrainian Airlines. Malaysian Airlines flight went down. Yeah, people were, you know, switching airlines because of that. Right? Because it's a bit of a scary thing. Well, it is a scary thing. It's not a bit of a scary thing. It's kind of a scary thing, but I mean, it's air travel or space travel. It's just risks involved with it. You need to be aware of that. But he said that his resolve was unshaken and claimed that that allowing wider access to space was still a deeply worthy goal. And, of course, indeed it is. A few people have asked for a refund, Mr. Whiteside's told the Telegraph. This is on the Telegraph website, I guess. I don't think that's surprising. And I think what is relevant is that the vast majority have said, don't give up, keep going, we're with you. So rock on. So 97% have been very supportive, but a few people have asked for a refund. My resolve is unshaken. I have always known that this would be a challenge. We didn't think we would have to go... I am reading this all weird. We didn't think that we would have to go through this type of event, but I've got a strong team and a team that knows we should open up space access as it is a deeply worthy goal. Before the accident, Virgin founder Sir Richard Branson said the first space tourism flights would begin in the spring of 2015, so 6 months from now, essentially, five, 6 months. Now Mr. Whiteside's Now Mr. Whitesides predicts that their new spacecraft, Spaceship 2, Serial 2, because Spaceship 2 was the one that crashed, so it's Spaceship 2 version 2, I guess, will begin test flights within 6 months. And I believe they're actually building this one as it's in crash. After that, he claims that it will be... He claims that it will be months, not years, until the first commercial flights begin, meaning that Galactic could still make its first launch next year, which is good. However, around 24 passengers have already pulled out and have had the $250,000 ticket price refunded. Although some may only have paid deposits, the company stands to lose more than 3 million. I believe that's pounds, or is that euro something? That's pounds. 3 million pounds in lost sales. Yeah, this is British site, so it's gonna be pounds. High-profile ticket holders include Angelina Jolie, Kate Winslet, and Stephen Hawking. Imagine Stephen Hawking floating in space. Interesting. The investigation into the accident is also likely to take more than a year, which, yeah, of course it would be. It's an air accident or space accident, what have you, which could hold up the project. Co-pilot Michael Alsbury, 39, died when the aircraft crashed in the Mojave Desert in California on October 31st, while surviving pilot Peters. While surviving pilot Peter Siebold, 43, is still recovering in hospital. The cause of the accident is under investigation by the National Transport Safety Board, the NTSB, which is focusing on whether Mr. Alsbury unlocked the ship's movable tail section early, before aerodynamic forces were right to keep the structure held in place as designed. About 2 seconds after the tail was unlocked, it began to swivel outward, likely triggering the vehicle's supersonic breakup and Mr. Alsbury's death. The pilots were testing the so-called feathering tail system as part of Spaceship 2's fourth rocket-powered test flight. The first since Virgin Galactic decided to use a new fuel to boost the space plane to higher altitudes. Pivoting the tail section for descent increases the ship's surface area so that it can float down to Earth, flying like a badminton shuttlecock. It had been used dozens of times during Spaceship 2's atmospheric test flights, including 2 rocket-powered flights. As the ship is rocketing upward, the tail is held fast by a large hook that is supposed to remain engaged until the aircraft reaches supersonic speed. At that point, the pilot releases the hook, though the tail remains pinned back by aerodynamic pressures. The command to actually move the tail into descent position comes after the rocket motor burns out near the apex of the ship's altitude to the highest point it's at, unlocking, which means it's in space, or the edge of it anyways. Unlocking the tail is done well before then, so that if the mechanism fails, the pilots can abort the flight. Okay. It is a great safety feature, but if you use your safety feature in a regime that is not designed to handle, bad things are going to happen. This thing runs essentially on the same premise of a parachute. The air catches it and it slows things down, right? So that's what this does. Well, let's say, for instance, on a much smaller scale, you launch a model rocket and all of a sudden your thing screws up and it's firing. One of your engines is firing, but all of a sudden the other one fires off its ejection charge and you pop your chute while it's still going. Yeah, what happens to the rocket? Well, the parachute deploys and it goes, whoo, spins out of control and essentially crashes in the ground. That's essentially what happened here too. Different scale, but you know. We're gonna leave off with that. Pass can abort the flight. Great safety measure, bad things are gonna happen. Mike Moses, Virgin Galactic Vice President of Operations, told Reuters, it's like your car airbag going off at 65 miles per hour. Yeah, that's not a good thing, too. Mr. Whitesides was watching the test flight from the Mojave Desert when the accident happened on Friday, October 31st. I think with all of these kinds of events, the first reaction is a kind of disbelief before reality sets in quite quickly, he said. The entire project has been dogged with problems. 2 of the 6 flights made by Spaceship One, that's the first spaceship that they had, suffered potentially catastrophic problems, and in 2007, an explosion killed 3 engineers. That was actually an engine test explosion, I believe, a ground test that killed 3 engineers, if I recall correctly. However, Mr. Whiteside said, we're still really focusing on trying to help the families and the injured pilot, but we are also looking to the future, and there is some measure of hope and optimism. People are starting to think about the tasks ahead rather than what happened on Friday. I wouldn't say that we have moved on, but we are starting to think about the future. So, that's good that they're... oh, man, sorry. Throat's all weird today. It is a tragic thing. with this accident and whatever. But you gotta realize that these people are test pilots. This is what they've signed up to do. They go out, they test aircraft, or in this case, spacecraft, to the extremes. They push the limits on these vehicles. That's what they're supposed to do. Now, you gotta think about, and people are like, oh, well, we're gonna cancel. And it's like, what, 3% of the total, I guess, customer base where Virgin Galactic has canceled the flights because of this. It's, I don't know, 3% is not too bad, I guess. But same, you gotta realize, at the same time, you have to realize that it's space flight, or it's air flight, or whatever. It's dangerous. Cars used to be pretty dangerous too, I guess, but, you know, car accidents back in the early 1900s. See those things, it would be like, it's just like two pop cans crushed against each other. Now you have a car accident, you run a car into a pole, and the car is still, well, mostly there, depending on the car, I guess, the newer cars. So, I mean, things get inherently safer as we go on. This vehicle was in a testing phase. It's like Apollo 1, when the Apollo program started, the first flight. They had a catastrophic failure. They had a fire in the crew capsule, and the three crew members died. That was a huge, huge thing, and people back then were like, oh, well, I guess we could cancel it or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But no, they said, no, screw this. We're here to innovate. We're here to push things forward, so we're going to do this. And it kept on going, and this is what Virgin's doing, and I hope they keep at it, because, honestly, spacecraft for non-military or non- NASA, I guess, non-government sponsored people, you know, for civilians, hey, why not? It costs an arm and a leg, and probably all of your firstborn children, but it's pretty cool, and I'd like to see them get this thing working. And people are complaining, oh, it's 10 years later, and blah, so nothing about it, but it's like a private company doing this, you know, so I think good on them, and they should keep on going. And to the next story. In Skynet News, thank you to Woggle War for this one, Google wants to store your genome. For $25 a year, Google will keep a copy of any genome in the cloud, which, yeah, no thanks. Google is approaching hospitals and universities with a new pitch. Have genomes? Store them with us. The search giant's first product for the DNA age is Google Genomics, a cloud computing service that it launched last March, but went mostly unnoticed and made a barrage of high-profile R&D announcements from Google, like one late last month about a far-fetched plan to battle cancer with nanoparticles. Click on the link there. Google Genomics could prove more significant than any of these moonshots, connecting and comparing genomes by the thousands and soon by the millions, is what's going to propel medical discoveries for the next decade. The question of who will store the data is already a point of growing competition between Amazon, Google, IBM, and Microsoft. Google began work on Google Genomics 18 months ago, meeting with scientists and building an interface, or API, that lets them move DNA data into its server farms and do experiments there using the same database tech that indexes the web and tracks billions of internet users. We saw biologists moving from studying one genome at a time to studying millions, says David Glazer, the software engineer who led the effort and was previously head of platform engineering for Google Plus, the social network. Bit of a step up there, I'd say. I am the software engineer manager, whatever, for Google Plus, for a social media network, and now I'm working on a genome project. Okay. But I guess you don't really need to know. I'm not going to go into it. I'm going to shoot myself in the foot, probably. The opportunity is how to apply breakthroughs in data tech to help with this transition. Some scientists scoff that genome data remains too complex for Google to help with, while others see a big shift coming when Etel Butte, a bioinformatics expert at Stanford, heard Google present its plans this year. He remarked that he now understood how travel agents felt when they saw Expedia. Yeah. The explosion of data is happening as labs adopt new, even faster equipment for decoding DNA. For instance, the Broad Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts said that during the month of October, it decoded the equivalent of one human genome every 32 minutes. I'd say that's pretty fast compared to, obviously, years before, decades even. That translated to about 200 terabytes of raw data. So I don't know if that's for the entire month or if that's just for one genome. Probably for an entire month, I would think. This flow of data is smaller than what is routinely handled by large internet companies. Over 2 months, Broad will produce the equivalent of what gets uploaded to YouTube in 1 day. But it exceeds anything biologists have dealt with. That's now prompting a wide effort to store and access data at central locations, often commercial ones. The National Cancer Institute said last month that it would pay $19 million to move copies of the 2.6 petabyte cancer genome atlas into the cloud. Copies of the data from several thousand cancer patients will reside both at Google Genomics and in Amazon's data centers. The idea is to create cancer genome clouds where scientists can share information and quickly run virtual experiments as easily as a web search, says Sheila Reynolds, a research scientist at the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle. Not everyone has the ability to download a petabyte of data. Yeah, because how long would that take you? Or has the computing power to work on it, she says, because a lot of computers don't have a petabyte worth of storage. Also, speeding the move of DNA data to the cloud has been a year-long price war between Google and Amazon. Google says it now charges about $25 a year to store a single genome, and more to do computations on it. Scientific raw data representing a single person's genome is about 100 gigs in size. Okay, so 100 gigs per person. Although a polished version of a person's genetic code is far smaller, less than a gig. Okay, that would cost only 25 cents per year. Cloud storage is giving a boost to startups like Toot Genomics, DNA Nexus, 7Bridges, and Nextcode Health. These companies build browsers that hospitals and scientists can use to explore genetic data. Google or Amazon is a backend. They are saying, hey, you can manage a genomics company in our cloud, says Denise Kirao, CEO of 7Bridges, which stores genome data on behalf of 1,600 researchers in Amazon's cloud. The bigger point, he says, is that medicine will soon rely on a kind of global internet of DNA which doctors will be able to search. Our bird's eye view is that if I were to get lung cancer in the future, doctors are going to sequence my genome and my tumor's genome and then query them against a database of 50 million other genomes, he says. The result will be, hey, here's a drug that will work best for you. At Google, Glazer says he has been working on Google Genomics as it became clear that biology was going to move from artisanal to factory scale data production. He started by teaching himself genetics, taking an online class. Not exactly too sure if taking an online class, whatever. Anyways, introduction to biology taught by Broad's chief, Eric Lander. He also got his genome sequence and put it on Google's cloud. Glazer wouldn't say how large Google Genomics is or how many customers it has now, but at least 3,500 genomes from public projects. Ooh, that's kind of scary. I already stored on Google servers. I wonder if they ask for permission to upload your stuff to Google servers if it's your genome. You know what I mean? Like you go in somewhere, you get some work done at the flesh mechanic, and then all of a sudden, check back in a month or two, and all of a sudden you see your stuff's up on the internet. Which is what this is, because cloud stuff is obviously on the internet. So one way or another, even if you can't access it, it's still there. He also says there's no link as of yet between Google's cloud and its more speculative efforts in healthcare. Like the company Google started this year called Calico, whatever you call it, to investigate how to extend human lifespans. What connects them is just a growing realization that tech can advance the state of the art in the life sciences, says Glazer. Somali Data, a physicist who manages Stanford University's largest computer cluster for genetics data, says that because of recent price cuts, it now costs about the same to store genomes with Google or Amazon as in her own data center. Prices are finally becoming more reasonable, and we think they will keep dropping, she says, and of course they will. Data says some Stanford scientists have started using a Google database system, BigQuery, that Glazer's team made compatible with genome data. It was developed to analyze large databases of spam, web documents, or of consumer purchases, but it can also quickly perform very large experiments comparing thousands or tens of thousands of people's genomes that researchers want to try. Sometimes they want us to do crazy things, and you need scale to do that, says Data. It can handle the scale the genetics can bring, so it's the right tech for a new problem. And even though I hate Google, I mean, I hate Google. It's like a love-hate relationship with me and Google because I love their services, but at the same time, it's what they do with the services and where that data goes and who uses it and who they send it off to and all other fun stuff. So I think the base idea behind this is actually a very cool thing. But at the same time, I think there's going to be some privacy issues that come up with that, quite possibly. I mean, it's you. It's the fundamentals of what you are. Or who you are, I guess, is your genome. Also, let's sell this information to the wrong person, or it gets leaked to the wrong person, or to the wrong government, you know, genome-specific weapons. Yeah, I know that's a little bit far. That's a bit of a stretch, Maltos, but, you know, that's just one of the things that comes to mind, hence the Skynet moniker for Google. I like the idea that it would advance medical science quite a bit, but I think that what needs to happen is I think another provider needs to be set up that is not a search provider, but not a big, huge conglomerate corporate mashup that Google is now buying up all these companies and stuff in all the different sectors. I think it should be a dedicated thing. And you know what I mean? People want from Google want to go off there, fine, whatever. But it should be a separate thing, and it shouldn't be cloud. I think that's stupid. But that's me, and I hate cloud services, so, you know, call me old-fashioned. Anyways, anybody have any thoughts on that? Send some feedback to newsreel2@gmail.com or go to newsreel.ca and click on the... Oh, I don't even know what the heck it is. There's a form on there you can fill out and send it off to us, and we'll still get it the same way. Anyways, in more space news, Rosetta space probe set to land on Comet for first time. This is going to be awesome. This is supposed to happen on November 12th. So that's going to be awesome. So just a few days from now. The European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft is preparing to land a probe on the surface of a moving comet within days. There's a video there at the top that explains it pretty good, like graphics and all that stuff. Go check it out. In the culmination of a decade-long mission across the solar system, put some more extra words in there. Culmination of a decade-long mission across the solar system, comet-chasing spacecraft Rosetta is now closing close enough to its target to send a probe down to study it. I think it's something with like 10 kilometers or 30 kilometers away from it now or something stupid like that. That's pretty freaking close. It's been orbiting it for the last month or so, anyways, or two. It is now close enough to blah, 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 send the probe down and study it. On Wednesday at 9:03 a.m., I'm going to assume this is in GMT, Greenwich Mean Time, because this is a British, this is the Telegraph website again. It will launch its landing craft Philadelphia, whatever, bound for the comet's icy surface. Scientists at the European Space Agency, the ESA, will face a nerve-jangling final few hours as they wait to find out whether their years of patience and calculations have resulted in a successful touchdown. If the spacecraft is misaligned by just 1 centimeter upon launch, the probe could drift hundreds of meters off target, putting the whole mission in jeopardy. The team has until 8 p.m. on Tuesday evening to decide if conditions are stable enough to go ahead. If successful... there's a blue box here that's gonna mess me up. Text. If successful, it is hoped that the probe will provide data that could reveal the origins of life on Earth. Made of ice, dust, and small rocky particles, it is likely that comets delivered the first water to Earth and may have even seeded the planet with the building blocks for life. So that's very cool. This thing is supposed to land. Like they're just dropping it. It's not gonna be thrusters or anything like that. You're just gonna like, whoop, we're gonna drop you. It's going to land, or attempt to land. It's got 3 legs, I guess. 3 legs or 6 feet or something stupid like that. But yeah, it's got drills in the legs, so when it makes contact, it's going to activate the drills so it can anchor itself. It's got a harpoon in the bottom of it, that in the center of it or something like that, that's going to shoot into the surface too to help anchor it. And it's also got a thruster on top. So because it's a low gravity environment, it touches down, it could bounce, so they have a thruster on top so that when it makes contact, it's going to thrust, so it's going to thrust itself into the ground while everything shoots down to anchor itself. So that's actually pretty cool tech there, I'd say. So I'm hoping that goes well. I think I'm going to be watching that live. I don't know if that's, I'm sure there's probably a live feed for that somewhere. And I'm pretty sure because it's going to be happening at 9:03 a.m. in Europe, England, wherever, that it's probably going to be during the time that I'm either at home at night or it's going to be during the time I'm working. So that should be pretty cool. I'm gonna watch it. I don't care. anyways, and our last story for today in pedophile news. Thank you to Wagga War for this one. The Dickens dossier, secret file on establishment pedophiles, may be opened. A secret file. Let's see here. Another caption here. File rumored to be locked in archives at Oxford University's Bodleian Library. I probably screwed that name up too, but whatever. A secret file which is said to contain the names of pedophiles with links to the British establishment, so I'm assuming that means the government. I could be wrong on that, but somebody please correct me on that. And which is rumored to be locked away in archives at the University of Oxford's Bodleian Library, could be made public as part of the government's child abuse inquiry. Inquiry panel members Barbara Hearn and Sharon Evans, along with Ben Emerson QC, not sure what QC stands for, but okay, counsel to the inquiry, assured campaigners at their meeting last week, shortly before Fiona Wolf announced she would be the second person to resign as chair. And I just heard a whole bunch of noise on my microphone that I'm not causing, so I'm assuming people are upstairs in the next apartment are walking around. And the microphone's picking that up. Hopefully I can cut that out. Meeting last week, shortly before Fiona Wolf announced she would be the second person to resign as chair, that they would have top-level security clearance and access to restricted or closed files. The whereabouts of the Dickens dossier containing allegations of pedophiles linked to the British establishment and compiled by former Conservative MP Geoffrey Dickens is unknown. It went missing after the politician handed it to the then Home Secretary, Leon Britton, whatever, in 1984, as are more than 100 documents concerning child abuse allegations that had been held by the Home Office. It is rumored that it may be in the Barbara Castle Archives within the University of Oxford's Bodleian Library. Insert picture of MP Geoffrey Dickens. Now, here's one extra thing. If you're going to be working and doing something, working on some document or whatever, or some work somewhere, or doing something, which is quite possibly controversial, or, you think might not see the light of day when you hand it off to somebody. You know, it's one of those things of high importance or something that people want to keep hidden type thing, or possibly. You should probably make a copy of it and maybe give it to somebody else. Because this guy, I think he's done a good thing, but he gave it to somebody else and now it's gone somewhere. So, anyways, just make copies. Ian Pace, who in 2013 organized a petition of musicians, called for a public inquiry into abuse in specialist music schools, and one of 21 campaigners at Friday's meeting, chaired by Home Office official Usha Choli, asked whether the panel would have access to closed archives such as those belonging to the former Labour cabinet minister under Harold Wilson. The answer seemed to be yes, said Mr. Pace. We were told the panel's security clearance would enable them to access things like intel files and closed archives, such as a lot of material contained within the Barbara Castle archives, where some people suspect she may have kept a copy of the dossier. Okay. At least three people have tried unsuccessfully to access the Castle files to see if it contains the Dickens dossier, but found a lot of the material closed. Some papers with restricted access include diary entries and correspondence with family members. All of her correspondence with the former Labour Home Secretary Jack Straw between October of 81 and February 99 is also marked closed on the library's database, along with a letter she wrote to Neil Kinnock in December of 99. Insert picture of Miss Barbara Castle, picture of 1974. Mr. Pace said, I do know of separate occasions where people went after a whole range of material where the Dickens dossier was likely to be, but could not see any of it. The Independent on Sunday revealed that the inquiry panel will have developed vetting, quote unquote, top-level clearance allowing them access to intel files and information. Home Secretary Theresa May told the Commons on Monday that the government was in the process of working out the protocol to ensure that access is possible between all agencies in the inquiry so that no stone is left unturned. Due to the number of ongoing cases and historical sexual abuse trials taking place in the coming months, campaigners have received assurances from the panel that witnesses could give evidence about people already on trial, with proceedings therefore sub judice. So that's very interesting. I really sincerely hope that they do find that file, a copy of it or something somewhere, so that, yeah, if you're a pedophile, you do need to be tried and, well, honestly, shot or whatever. That's my opinion, you know, and I'm kind of a bit cut and dry and stuff like that. But yeah, pedophiles are for killing, right? Good old quote from John Kennedy, pedophiles are for killing. So anyways, that's all we have for the news there today. But let me close this here, and we got some Recomedia. We don't have any Daily Hack or Cyberpunk Kit today. That's okay. Maybe we'll have some next week. Anyways, getting to the Recomedia, we have something sent in by Kevin is a Geek. It's a map, really, called Don't Fly Drones Here. It's only for the U.S. right now, or the author of this map only put it out for the U.S. It shows areas where you can't fly drones, or as I like to call them, UAVs, or UAS, unmanned aerial systems, whatever. Where in the States they have actually prevented that. So obviously around major airports, this shows a 5-mile radius around medium to large size airports on this map. Apparently U.S. military bases, again, illegal to fly in those areas. U.S. national parks, because U.S. National Park Commission is a bunch of idiots now, and you cannot fly drones or UAVs in national parks. So it has all of those listed. And TFRs, which are temporary flight restrictions. And there's a big one in, it's one in North Dakota, near Grand Forks, probably because that's where there's a lot of nukes, quite possibly, for national security reasons. And there's another one in, around Washington, Washington DC is obviously a temporary flight restriction in effect there. That's the only two I can see on the map readily. And there's one near Moline, Kansas, which I'm not sure what's there, but it looks like nothing. So, also like any air testing ranges for the military, all that fun stuff. So that's on there, so it's pretty cool. So go take a look at that. And if you ever wondered, because, you know, people like me, it's actually some that are kind of crossed into Canada. Wow, there's one in Canada, Cornwall Regional Airport. That's restricted, apparently. I'm assuming that the Americans use that for some reason. Anyways, that's kind of cool. So go take a look at that if you're interested in UAVs, drones, whatever you want to call them. Also, just on a side note, I am currently waiting on parts, about $300 worth of equipment for the second in the Flying Monkey UAV series. It's going to be a custom scratch built UAV, and it's just going to be super cheap right now. I'm not buying an airframe for it, right? So it's going to be big R&D thing here in a few weeks. So hopefully I'll have some updates on that when I get all the parts in the mail and start building. So yay, I'll keep you all up to date on that. Also, more Recomedia, there's a new game out. I don't know when the heck it came out. It's in beta right now, beta testing. A multiplayer game called Cerberium by the same people who put out Stalker, all the Stalker series of games. So it's obviously Russian. Seems pretty cool so far. It's kind of iffy, I find, even on this computer that I'm running, which actually has a good amount of power for a lot of games. It's still kind of wonky, but it's in beta, of course, right? So I did play it out for about an hour or so. It's not too bad. It's like the standard run and gun, kill each other, you know, same thing as Call of Duty, multiplayer, and, I don't know, Unreal Tournament and all that other fun stuff, or Unreal 2004 or whatever. So yeah, it's kind of cool. And it's really, even though the graphics kind of not, I'd say, subpar right now, it looks nice. Everything's abandoned and stuff, right? So I love that stuff. Anyways, and the last thing for Recomedia that we have is the Adapter Project, which, from what I see, it's all done in Russian, and it's actually, I believe, a survival series based on, or done in conjunction with Cerberium, the game. I think it's made by the creators of the game. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think it's on their official YouTube page. But he's got, it's this guy, he's out in van factory or something like that. And he's just talking about random survival things and stuff. So it's actually kind of cool. I don't know if a lot of it's, well, I think a lot of it's actually, well, I haven't seen it all. So I think some of it, or a lot of it, is actually pretty good. A lot of it you wouldn't use, probably, too. But he had some good ideas for water purification and stuff like that. And yeah, so check that out, too. Pretty cool. And definitely check out the game. You can get, it's like a closed beta, but there's free, do Google search for free beta code for that game. You'll find it. I found it, so that's how I found it. But that's all we have for you today. But don't worry, we'll be back next week to make sure you get the news that you need to survive. This has been a free WOGcast brought to you by the WOGs Who Care. If you cannot donate to the show, please distribute. But if you can donate, please do so by clicking on the Donate tab on the Rant Media website. Thank you to the Army of the Flying Monkeys and their assistance in gathering data. If you have information that you would like to send to us, you can reach us at newsreel2@gmail.com, or you can send us the information through our website at newsreel.ca. If you like the music in the background, please be sure to check out Rant Radio Industrial, because it's an awesome channel. We will be fading out now with a track from Absurd Minds called Captivated. Remember everyone, we will never defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.